She was a symbol of continuity in the United Kingdom for 7 decades. But after Queen Elizabeth II's death, what does the future hold for the monarchy and how will she be remembered? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Imran Khan. Tributes have been pouring in for Britain's Queen Elizabeth II, who's died at the age of 96. She's been praised for her compassion and warmth and described as a role model and an inspiration to millions. Buckingham Palace says she died peacefully on Thursday afternoon at her Scottish estate, Balmoral. The crown has passed to her oldest son, who's now known as King Charles III. The Queen's long reign saw widespread changes across the country that she ruled over, as well as the world that she lived in. Throughout everything, she remained a constant, as Niamh Barker now reports.
Her reign saw years of dramatic change, a social, cultural and technological revolution that altered the very landscape of the nation. But the Queen retained the same values, the same habits, an unchanging presence in a country living through times of turmoil and conflict. She was just 25 when she came to the throne, exactly the same age as the first Queen Elizabeth, and was only 18 at the end of the Second World War, where she'd served as an ambulance driver. Only 8 years later, she was being crowned.
On almost every level, kind of politically, culturally, in terms of technological innovation, in terms of sort of society, I mean, every sort of massive change in the late 20th century, obviously, she's lived through. So things ranging from, obviously, the fall of the Berlin Wall in Europe, end of apartheid in Africa, in England, the first female prime minister, the first black president in America. So those kind of landmarks. Also things like the development of the World Wide Web, which has obviously had a huge impact on society.
The Queen very much led the way in technology as far as royal families are concerned. As far back as 1997, she actually was fully behind launching the royal family's first website for the British monarchy. And then in more recent years, we saw her get fully behind things like a Facebook page for the monarchy in 2010. And all these things, while they were being developed, royal aides would always say they were sent right to the top. So it wasn't just that they were being worked on by press secretaries. She oversaw all those developments in technology and she embraced them.
As head of state, she was also all too aware of a new kind of national threat.
We in the UK had lived with terrorism for a long time, particularly after the Second World War with the problems in Northern Ireland. She was shocked that a new wave of terrorism, Islamic terrorism, had hit London, and defiantly she stood in that central arch over there at Buckingham Palace and observed a 2-minute silence. And I say defiantly as if to say, you can bomb us, but we'll not falter.
And as Britain shifted to become a more multicultural society and one that was more accepting of divorce, the Queen's family too seemed to adapt when one of her grandsons, Prince Harry, married Meghan Markle, a biracial American actress who had been married before. Yet months after the wedding, differences began to emerge, and eventually the couple made allegations of racism against members of the royal household.
Harry and Meghan and the rest of the royal family started off with the best of intentions. We're going to work together. We're going to take the royal family into the 21st century. But how do you change a medieval Western European system overnight? It's very difficult to do that.
The Queen said the family was saddened by the couple's decision to step back from the royal family and move to the United States. When she came to the throne, the Queen made a promise to the nation.
Whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service and to the service of our great imperial family to which we all belong.
It was a pledge many would say she managed to fulfil, remaining a constant in an ever-changing world. Niamh Barker, Al Jazeera, London.
We'll bring in our guests in just a moment, but first, let's take a closer look at the role of the British monarchy. It's known as a constitutional monarchy, meaning the sovereign is the head of state but doesn't rule. That's done by the government, and the monarch must work in conjunction with the parliament. So the powers are symbolic and ceremonial and are meant to be politically neutral. The monarch is also the head of state for 14 other Commonwealth countries. These include Australia, Canada, Jamaica and New Zealand. In all these roles, the monarch is supported by members of the royal family. Let's bring in our guests. Joyce Sigurd is a writer, editor and author of Jamaicans in Britain, A Legacy of Leadership. She joins us from London. Ian Lloyd is a royal writer and former royal photographer. He joins us from Oxford. And Zayed Belbaji is the managing partner of Hardcastle Advisory, a London-based political consultancy, and is also a political commentator and advisor. He also joins us from London. Long live the Queen, or rather, long live the King, and the Queen is dead. All of these things we keep hearing. We keep hearing of the legacy of this woman. I want to bring in Ian Lloyd here in Oxford. Ian, you spent a lot of time with the Queen. You took a number of pictures of her. You went on key visits with her. We keep hearing this idea that she was the epitome of duty, that she knew exactly what she was doing. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. She was trained by her parents because her father came to the throne unexpectedly when his brother abdicated in 1936. So he was landed with the job of king without any experience. And he was determined that the same thing wouldn't happen to his daughter. So although she was only 25 when she became queen, she was trained by the king. So she saw documents from the time of the Second World War and had her own box of government papers from the Foreign Office so that she could get used to being the Queen. And I think when she started, I interviewed later on a private secretary of the Queen's, and he said in the early days she was always saying, "What would my father have done?" So she was very keen to continue that legacy, and she was a very disciplined person as well, who was very good at the executive side of the job of the reading the documents and you know, assiduously kind of training herself, I suppose, on the job from when she became Queen in 1952.
Well, Ian, just the idea of her that she knew what she was doing, that she had this sense of duty, but for over seven decades, the world completely changed. And she was there guiding Britain almost through many of those changes. Was she aware of the kinds of seismic shifts that were going on? Or was she kind of insulated from all of that?
I think she's very aware of it. I mean, as she took her role as mother of the country, if you like, very seriously, she read a certain amount of the correspondence that was sent to her by ordinary men and women. And she would say that the expression is the book stops here. She knew that that people quite often had failed to get something, whether it's an operation or something, and they didn't know who to turn to. So they wrote to the Queen, and she was very experienced tried to find out what people wanted. The other thing that she did was every day she read all the newspapers. So she was aware of what was happening, the mood in the country. The only time, of course, she got it wrong was during the week Diana died. And I don't think she could quite get used to that sudden change that came about when the Princess of Wales was killed in 1997.
Let's bring in Joy here. Joy, what we're hearing from Ian seems to be what a lot of people are saying, that she did have this sense of duty, that she was this woman that presided over like seven decades and these seismic shifts, and she was aware of them. But I don't know if that's really the case. I mean, the royal household in particular is incredibly white. It didn't really, in fact, it didn't employ a person of British colour until very, very recently. It seemed to be out of touch with what was going on in her own country. What do you think?
Well, I would actually slightly disagree with that. I do believe that Queen Elizabeth II was very much in touch with, or she had some insight into all of her subjects. She was always, there have always been people of colour in the royal household for hundreds of years in one capacity or other. We know very well about Queen Victoria. We know George the Third. he had a black wife or partially black from a black descendant, black African descent. And so she also raised her children in the same way. And I do know that they always had, they were always in touch, certainly with members from the black community, whether they be from England or throughout the Commonwealth.
Well, let's bring in Zaid Balbaji here. Joy makes an interesting point. There have been people from various walks of life in the royal household. I mean, the example of Queen Victoria was mentioned there, but she was the Empress of India. She'd brought over a Indian person to basically help her understand the country she was ruling. This is a legacy of colonialism. It wasn't multicultural Britain that we're talking about, right, when it came to Queen Elizabeth II?
I again would politely disagree in some respects. I'll explain why. It's the seven decades of rule that you mentioned again, an extraordinary period in world history. The Queen oversaw imperialism, fascism, communism, and took us through to the tech age. And I think as a monarch who started her reign, you know, as the sovereign of 70 countries to today, she managed that process and Britain's shifting role in the world with aplomb. And I think the royal family has done well to reconfigure itself towards people of different colour and different communities. And that's definitely something that King Charles is about. He's stated that over and over.
Ian Lloyd, it's an extraordinary legacy, isn't it? Especially when you consider, you know, the seven decades that she has been in this job. But you've also got to consider, we also have to consider in Britain the impact of this, the judiciary, the legal system, all on Her Majesty's service. All, she's the ceremonial head. That suddenly changes to His Majesty. Does that make a difference at all, do you think?
Well, it's going to take some getting used to. I mean, you know, like you say, lawyers are Queen's counsellors and now they're King's counsellors. And one thing we'll notice straight away or soon will be the change in the King's image on banknotes and coins. It's you'd have to be about 80 years old now to remember a time when we sang God Save the King and the King's head was on the stamps and the coins. So it's going to take some getting used to. All during my life and people much older than me, everything has been in the presence of the Queen and quite often the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh. So it's going to take an awful lot of adjustment, I think. But I mean, it happened when the Queen became Queen. So it equally, it's going to happen again, but we're just not used to it. 70 years is an amazing amount of time, isn't it?
I mean, Joy, when Queen Elizabeth II came into the head of the royal family and became queen, we lived in a very different world. There wasn't the internet. There wasn't this kind of 24-hour scrutiny that was on the royal family. We now have seen the effect of that 24-hour scrutiny. We've seen everything blow up, any kind of controversy blow up into something like huge, where people start talking about it on talk shows. The royal family is so much more public now than it ever was. Do you think King Charles is capable of dealing with that?
I do, actually. And I think for the last couple of decades, he's been really very well prepared. And he's shown a great interest in particularly in London. It's very evident the diversity of the country. He has involved himself in schemes that have actually uplifted many people from ethnic minorities, and given them opportunities, whether it's through the Prince's Trust or any other scheme that he has done. And he's really come to the forefront. And I have to say, I'm quite looking forward to seeing what other changes he will make to the establishment.
Zaid Balbaji, do you agree with that? It seems quite an optimistic assessment.
It is optimistic, though we're missing one other thing here, which is the role that the monarchy has externally. And I think we're seeing that in the tributes, etc. You saw the tribute from Vladimir Putin, I'm sure. Really remarkable. The same, you know, the UK has a very difficult relationship with Europe. The tributes from the EU and President Macron were remarkable in the same regard. And I think the monarchy has its role in Britain retaining its influence on the world stage, and the Queen, you know, certain relationships and certain a certain personal rapport will be lost with the passing of the Queen. However, King Charles is representing an institution, and he will be able to benefit from some of that institutional memory on the diplomatic stage, definitely.
Ian, King Charles II, when he was Prince... Charles III, in fact. But when he was Prince Charles, he was... He actually took an active look at what the royal family meant. And down to the minutiae of, like, how many members of the royal household should there be, he was taking a look at what the monarchy meant in the 21st century. Now he has a chance to actually change the monarchy. Will he change it? Will he take that chance?
I think in certain ways, definitely. I mean, an obvious one is the number of people who are members of the royal family. If you ask people in the street what they don't like about the monarchy, quite often it's what they call the hangers-on, the distant relatives, the cousins and so on. And I think he will streamline the monarchy, so we'll get rid of Prince Andrew. Well, he's already gone, but I mean... the focus will be very much on the immediate line of succession, with certain exceptions. Obviously, the Princess Royal does a fantastic job and would be very much part of the firm, and I think with Edward and Sophie as well. But apart from that, the very great number of royals will be reduced. And I think he'll think about certain things like the palaces. I mean, we're still not too early to say what will happen, but there was rumours that he might make Windsor Castle his seat of government, if you like, and the Buckingham Palace will be permanently open to the public. But it could be the other way around, we don't know yet. But I think there will be quite a lot of changes. I think he's more open to changes probably than the Queen was, because the Queen was a great traditionalist, and she was of the opinion, you know, if it's not broken. Sorry, I've just forgotten the phrase now. But you know, she didn't really want to change that much. So I think yes, it could be an interesting time for the monarchy, certainly in terms of adapting to the future.
Joy, is adapting enough, or does it need a radical change?
I think the adaptation began quite some time ago, actually. It's been very slow, but it's been evolving over the years. And we've seen that. I mean, they had no option when Princess Diana died than to make some radical changes. And they made a complete turnaround. And now, I mean, irrespective of what's happened, King Charles has two black grandchildren. I mean, you know, this has been happening very slowly, but very certainly. And I do feel that it's going in the right direction. I mean, we can't expect changes overnight, you know, but it is going in the right direction. Especially these times are very difficult because a number of the former colonies, they no longer want to be part of they no longer want the British monarchy to be at their head, but at the same time, they want to maintain a very good relationship with them. And it's not to forget that these people from all these countries, they all loved Queen Elizabeth.
Well, let's talk about the Commonwealth. It's actually one of the things that I certainly will always associate with Queen Elizabeth II. She seemed to be very much bought into the idea of the Commonwealth. She's certainly somebody that kept the idea going for a very long time. Zahid Belbaji, the Commonwealth is a ridiculous name, though, because it's a legacy of colonialism. It's a legacy of Britain taking and stealing a lot of countries' wealth and then calling it the Commonwealth. But beyond that, is the Commonwealth now still something that King Charles will take on? Because it seemed to me very much his mother's project.
In some respects, yes, because she was the monarch that oversaw the shrinking of British territories. As I said, when she became queen, she was the queen of 70-plus countries. In terms of it being associated with her, I mean, it remains the second largest international organisation in the world. It has the ability to do a lot more. We saw Prince Charles in recent years, as the transition was taking place, take a more active role. But I also think there's scope for Britain's role in the world to be increased somewhat. I mean, in recent memory, the Queen was on postage stamps in Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait and what is now the UAE. And I think that the Commonwealth has missed a step in some respects in making sure that all of the areas in which Britain had some influence, that it's not extended further. The monarchy is also able to kind of retain Britain's relationship and expand upon them elsewhere. The Queen oversaw the period of the special relationship with the United States. And, for example, not going too far, in recent years, the relationship with Morocco has undergone a renaissance. Morocco and the United Kingdom have had a relationship for 800 years. And the depth of that is because of this interdynastic relationship. So I think the monarchy can do a lot more to build Britain's place in the world upon the progress that they've already had in recent decades.
I mean, Ian Lloyd, Britain is off to a head start because of its unique position within the Commonwealth. You went to several of those countries with the Queen herself. You took pictures with her. You must have witnessed the warm welcome and the politics of all of this, but now we are witnessing countries wanting to get rid of the monarchy as their head of state, but like Joy said, still wanting to maintain a warm relationship. Is there an opportunity here for King Charles to be able to do that?
Yes, although obviously he, to a certain extent, he's limited because of his age. I mean, I suppose that the Queen was 25 and she put in the legwork in the early years of her reign. I mean, the first tour of Australia, New Zealand and Jamaica and some Pacific islands was almost 6 months. So because it had to be by sea in those days, Prince Charles won't be able to have that sort of intense sort of amount of time in the country. So I suppose he a lot of it will devolve onto William and Catherine, I suppose. But I can imagine that a lot of the countries will use this opportunity now to replace the Queen or the King now as head of state, because having been to Australia, I mean, it is very odd to be at the other end of the world and have the Queen's head on the notes and the stamps again, you know. So it's I think that's almost going to happen very, I imagine, fairly soon. But at the same time, he and William, I think, will use the Commonwealth for their own initiatives, particularly things like the environment and that. So rather than just being a political organisation, I think it will be a useful body of people.
Sorry, Ian, we are running out of time. I do want to very quickly come to Joy as well. Joy, we're talking about the Commonwealth now and the fact that it could be retold. You actually mentioned the idea that, you know, a lot of countries may well replace the Queen, the King rather, now, as I'm going to make that mistake for a while. We all are, I think, for a while. But is that a good thing for the Commonwealth? For
Britain? I see the Commonwealth as, today, the Commonwealth, the actual original term can be used today for a different manifestation. And really, I mean, so many of these countries, as somebody mentioned earlier, that they have issues with the fact that they feel that England has, Britain has in the past, taken their wealth, taken their resources and so on, and pulled it for themselves and called it the Commonwealth. Well, today we can actually turn that around to everybody's advantage, because there's a lot of negotiating that has already started and needs to go on in terms of not just reparations, but making good on some of the things that have happened in the past that have been negative towards some of these countries. And I think it could be a good thing to have that dialogue and that body of people together, coming together, so that it can be something that's actually profitable for both sides, for all involved, not just one person or not just the head of the Commonwealth.
I want to thank all our guests, Joy Sigurd, Ian Lloyd and Zaid Balbaji. And I want to thank you too for watching. You can see the programme again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Imran Khan, and the whole team here, bye for now.